So in order to decolonize international relations, I suppose we need to do three things, right? First, we need a story of how the discipline can be understood as colonial, to what extent that makes sense to say. Second, we need some tools that help us interrogate rather than take for granted these colonial coordinates of what it is that we're studying. And third, we need different strategies for challenging this, not just intellectually and in theory, but institutionally, understanding that international relations is not just a set of ideas, but a set of practices in the world in which power and institutions and knowledge practices all kind of come together. So first, we need a story of how and why the discipline is colonial. So some recent work has developed on this. So the old story that they used to tell about international relations and its kind of creation myth was that it was founded to study the causes of war such as to end it. So you have a moment, which I was taught in my graduate and undergraduate seminars, that in 1919 they start establishing chairs of international relations in the wake of the First World War so that, you know, never again will we have such dreadful wars. So that's one of its kind of central foundation myths. The second foundation myth sees the explosion of international relations really in the Cold War environment, right? And so it really takes off in the United States as part of a study of how to manage and contain the Soviet threat, and so it becomes very focused on nuclear weapons and military strategy and so on. So recently there have been revisionist stories of how international relations came to be and what its objects of study were. So I want to refer you to two volumes here. One is by Brian Schmidt and David Long, which I can't remember the year exactly, it was in the 90s, but it located the origins of international relations actually within the crisis of imperialism. And it's a study of how to manage imperial power in an age where there were many challenges to it. And so many of the original thinkers, or the kind of founding thinkers, supposedly, of international relations, were centrally concerned with this problem of empire. The other book that I'll refer you to is Robert Vitalis's recent work, White World Order, Black Power Politics, that argues that race was a central concern of early international relations, particularly at the turn of the 20th century and shortly after that, and that it was centrally concerned with problems of race relations. There were fears of race wars amongst the people, particularly in North America, but also as a result of pressures for decolonization in Asia and Africa. Now, these revisionist histories give us a lens into the centrality of race and empire for the conduct of world politics, particularly in the early 20th century. Now, most of this is erased by the time we get to telling the stories of international relations in, say, the 80s, 90s, 2000s, because decolonization has happened, and it's assumed that that's taken care of that problem, and so now we just study relations between states, and states are these state-like objects, and they have sovereignty, and they're all alike, and that's how we treat them. What does it mean for this to be a colonial discipline? I'll give you an example, which I think demonstrates how and why the colonial origins of international relations centrally shape its debates. And this is the example of the Correlates of War project. So the Correlates of War is one of the most influential data sets in international relations. So it was begun in the 1970s by Singer and some other colleagues, and it's a huge data set of all interstate wars, or what they call all wars over time, and it's coded alongside a number of variables. So this is a huge data set, and it has produced loads and loads of international relations raw data, including the democratic peace theory, which is the theory that democratic states don't go to war with each other, right? It came out of this data set. What does this data set assume? Right, it assumes that the only things that count are things which are called states, or which are recognized as states. So prior to decolonization, it does not include any non-European and Western polities, with the exception of a few such as Japan and China that were other empires. It doesn't include any wars between groups that they could not pin a kind of sovereignty on. And it does not include anything in which the recorded battle deaths are fewer than 1,000. And of course, we have issues with the historical record here. It also assumes that countries like Britain, America, France were democracies for this period. And if we think seriously about this, the subjects that fell under Britain in terms of having mass franchise, this really doesn't happen until the early 20th century. I mean, so even the coding of democracies is kind of relativized in terms of how things are understood. So in terms of how the Correlates of War project proceeds, it proceeds as if, for example, the 19th century was a zone of basically peace amongst the powers. Now, anybody familiar with the stories of empire colonialism, settler colonialism and expansion would contest this as a peaceful century, right? Would contest this idea of 100 years peace as Krishna does in a 2001 piece. But the point is that this data set is foundational to the discipline and it's fully coded through a Eurocentric and colonial conception of who and what counts as data. To think about more recent examples or even critical theory, so critical theory which has been popular, I suppose, in the UK in IR, is also replete with assumptions about who and what counts in terms of the study of world politics. I recently did a project looking at criticisms of liberal peace building, and a lot of these were rooted in Foucauldian readings of governmentality. They were rooted in attempts to theorize hybridity in peace building contexts. But for the most part, they did not engage in any serious way with the people who were the targets or the subjects of that peace building project. So they developed political critique, but it was political critique that assumed the non-speaking character of those people in peacebuilding context. So in terms of thinking about the discipline and its disciplinary gaze, the decolonizing project is about just decentering that set of perspectives that identifies who counts, what objects counts, and how we're going to study them. So in terms of the strategies that we have for challenging these conceptions, this is more about thinking about how IR is institutionalized, where it exists, right? It exists in syllabuses, it exists in textbooks, it exists in professional associations and conferences, right? It is in the world in terms of scholarship committees and journals and peer review practices, right? These are all the sites at which IR, if you like, takes place. So in terms of decolonizing the discipline, obviously the work of developing the consciousness of the exclusions of the present setup needs to take place in all of these settings. I'll just talk briefly about a couple of things that I've been involved with, which is the creation of institutional spaces within professional associations in order to create space for these conversations. So one is the Global Development Section at the International Studies Association. And that's been running for about 20 years and was conceived back then. And there was relatively little work on race and post-colonialism in IR at the time, but there was a little bit. It was conceived back then as a kind of critical IPE group thinking about inequality in world politics. So, I mean, IR has many flaws as a discipline, but one of its central flaws continues to be the separation of the political from the economic and how we conceive of structures of power. So it was supposed to be a kind of critical development studies orientation within international studies. Over the last 20 years, it has grown into sort of the fifth or sixth largest section within the ISA. So this is where, you know, all the US foreign policy types come and talk to each other and so on. It is the fifth or sixth largest section. It organizes 100 odd panels and is increasingly developed as a space to discuss and talk about questions of like post-coloniality, race, ecology, gender, like all kinds of issues like this. But the point is there is now a platform, and so people who come through that section or that bit of organizing have resources in terms of bibliographic resources, networks with each other, and some of them have gone on to produce textbooks, some of them have gone on to lead associations and so on. So that's been running for about 20 years, and it occurs in the major kind of North American international relations space. The other one that I've been involved with, which Arati mentioned in her opening, is the Colonial, Postcolonial, Decolonial Working Group of the British International Studies Association. So this was started about 4 years ago. It started in 2013, in order to bring together what were kind of disparate conversations, some connected with what was going on at the ISA, again, in order to cultivate a space. So that came alongside setting up a website, setting up a mailing list, setting up a book series kind of associated with that section. And it quickly became the largest section within the British International Studies Association. So institutionally now it has a lot of power. We have a certain allocation of panels at the conferences, which is now bigger and larger and so on. So what I would say is there's a combination of both separatist and insurrectionist strategies, and we're probably better at the separatist ones at the moment. That is the creation of new spaces and new platforms in which to bring out particular readings of the international. Now, the separatist strategies are great insofar as they foster an environment in which you can discuss and develop these ideas, but actually a lot of it allows the hegemonic structures to kind of continue, right? So the democratic peace debate, for example, still goes on, even though the data set on which it has been based has been systematically discredited in all kinds of ways by critical thinkers. People still make careers out of the democratic peace and discussing it and debating it and tweaking it and so on. So in that sense, the insurrection has not been wholly successful. And people say, oh, that's great, you know, we have a theoretically pluralist kind of discipline, and some people can do this thing, some people can do that thing. So. But that doesn't really satisfy me insofar as I think if you have systematically discredited a major pillar of the theory, then you should probably look at that again and do something else. one of the issues that we have had that I'll come on to now is the constraint of what I call race taboos. Well, I don't call them, other people call them race taboos in the discipline, which means that some of the political urgency behind decolonizing international relations has been kind of deflected, right? And it's been deflected in part because people now frame this as a problem of Eurocentrism or Western centrism, and they can kind of acknowledge and forgive their own Euro or Western centrism within a broader framework where they're like, well, just, you know, the world is Eurocentric, so there. And if you want to have a look at this in more detail, there's a set of very interesting debates around the publication of John Hobson's book, which is a very good book, on the Eurocentric conception of world politics. Now, what Hobson does is go through a range of very influential international relations thinkers from mid-18th century to the late 20th century and talk about how different kinds of Eurocentrism influence their analyses. It's a long book and it's a very detailed book, and I thoroughly recommend it. However, Hobson refuses to call anyone but kind of hardcore eugenicist scientific racists racist, right? So on his reading, Columbus is not a racist, right? Lugard is not a racist, Huntington is not a racist, and Trump is not a racist, okay? Because you can only be racist if you subscribe to some biological scientific theory of race, which is obviously problematic, and I think a lot of people responding to that book said, look, why are you doing this? And his defense was kind of interesting. It was like, okay, well, I don't want to call people racist if they're not racist, because that's essentially mean, and strategically it'll shut down the conversation. But so now we have this problem whereby people say, okay, this is Eurocentric, so now we need to just bring in Chinese perspectives, or we need to bring in Indian perspectives. And in a way, the answer to that problem is actually just additive rather than transformative. So what does this mean? I mean, I'm doing some work at the moment on trying to work against that conception of what it means to decolonize as a purely additive strategy. But work, I think, does need to be, if you like, insurrectionist precisely for this problem, because if you can't identify Donald Trump as a racist, then in some sense you're doing your political analysis wrong. I don't know what you're doing, but I mean, I'm not saying Trump is the only racist. He's not exceptionally racist. Trump is clearly working with a white supremacist discourse that is both explicit and latent in the long durée in Western political thinking. And this is important to point out. We look at Trump's deportations and go, oh, shock, horror. But Obama deported over 2 million people during his presidency, right? Even at the rate Trump is deporting people, it will not come anywhere near to Obama unless he radically accelerates. What has happened under Trump is that is open violence against people of color, and this has also happened in the wake of Brexit, open violence against people of color throughout the West in a way which we thought had been reduced a bit prior to that. But all of this means that we need to fundamentally rethink how we understand race and racism in the present day. And I think one of the central projects for decolonizing international relations is being able to articulate that in a way which is robust and theoretically constructive, but which doesn't let people off the hook by just saying, and I've literally heard people say this, I don't mind about being Eurocentric because the historical record is Eurocentric. And like, that's just not an acceptable way forward, I think. So I look forward to talking to you about this. I will leave it there.
All right, well, thanks very much. So what I'm going to talk about are just some kind of reflections on the last kind of year and a half that I've been here, and then on the about 4 years that I spent at Makerere University in Kampala from 2011 to 2014. And this is drawing on some talks that I was giving there and sort of bringing those into this context, and sort of rethinking some of the questions we were dealing with there from the position that I find myself in now. So there at Makerere, I was fortunate enough to be involved in an effort to transform graduate education at what was called the Makerere Institute of Social Research, or MISR, as we called it, with the director was Mahmoud Mamdani. George Bob Milliar is a survivor of that period as well, so it's great to see him here, and I hope he can contribute to this as well. Now, as most of you probably know, Makerere still enjoys a kind of mythical reputation due to its role in the 50s, 60s, the importance that it had in terms of training an entire generation of intellectuals and political leaders in East Africa and further on. But of course, with the violence of the 70s, structural adjustment in the 80s, it's now kind of a shell of what it used to be. MISR turned into basic, MISR is Makerere Institute of Social Research. So MISR had basically turned into a consultancy outfit. Most lecturers had to spend their time on second or third jobs. A lot of my friends farmed on weekends in order to make ends meet. And as you might imagine, research culture in that kind of context had basically died, and graduate education was very tenuous. So at MISR in 2011, we embarked on a project of creating a PhD program that would kind of provide the resources, both material and intellectual, for those who were studying there to come up with research questions for themselves. Because we thought this was the real, what had really disappeared, was the ability and the possibility of coming up with the research questions for oneself in a donor-driven context where the questions were provided from the outside by donors or by collaborating academics from places like here. Now, of course, like any radical project, it's seen successes and failures. But what I want to emphasize is that our vision was to create a program that wouldn't just study Uganda, wouldn't just study East Africa, or even just Africa. Rather, it was to provide the opportunity for students and staff to sort of rethink the world from an African location, to do theory from a non-Western location. And so it was an interdisciplinary program, PhD program, that we set up, what we called, after long debate, social studies, for lack of a better term. But within this, students picked one concentration, whether political studies, cultural studies, political economy, or history. The PhD program, we got it up and going in 2012. It's still going on today, has almost 50 students there now. We set it up so that it starts with 2 years, the students start with 2 years of coursework, and then 3 years of dissertation, research, and writing. And of course, we're faced with a sort of monumental set of questions over what to teach, how to set this kind of thing up. So we took Nyerere's advice that we must run where others walk, And we ended up setting up an entire first year curriculum in a matter of a couple months. Now, of course, in doing so, we were drawing on what we had at hand, figuring that as we moved ahead over the next few years, we could rework things and reconfigure in order to make it more appropriate. And as we figured out what was needed in that context, we saw it as sort of an ongoing experiment that we were undertaking. And so my duty, I took the duty of teaching political theory. Here at Cambridge, I'm somehow an Africanist, which I never considered myself, but when I applied for a job here, it was in African politics, and I said, all right, that's what I need to do to get a job. I will take it. But my training was in political theory at graduate school, mostly Western political theory, Frankfurt School, sort of contemporary critical theory. And so in the first year, we set up four classes for that first year. We had among them, we had Mamdani's sort of famous major debates in the study of Africa. He was teaching that, and he was teaching the modern state and the colonial subject, second term. I was teaching two classes on political theory. The first one, Western political thought, pre-modern, and then one sort of modern contemporary political theory. We had history of economic theory, the agrarian question. We recruited a political economist for that. We had a class on gender and history and Africa before Western hegemony. And for those, we brought in some historians from elsewhere in Makere. Later, we introduced classes on slavery and slave trades, culture and theory, colonization, decolonization, and post-colonialism, one on late industrialization, historical research and sources in African history, anthropology of violence. And they've been developing since then, too. So what I want to focus on is the discipline that I taught, which was political theory. Now, our first approach, once again, because we were putting this all together in a very, very short period of time, first approach was to put together a two-class political theory sequence. The first one, Western political theory, Plato to Marx. The second, called contemporary political theory. Now, because we were just drawing on what we had, and I had taught this previously as a grad student, it didn't look very different from the way political theory courses look on the books at any sort of Western or American university. Of course, we made it clear to our students that we were not reading this literature as sort of the solitary, self-evident tradition of political theory in uppercase, and that we were rejecting the kind of Eurocentric historical narrative that sees all political theory before 1500 as necessarily leading up to the modern European state. Now, while getting away from that mythology, we also felt important to teach this material because we wanted students to be equipped with the critical tools needed to understand the modern state. And to do this, we felt that we all had to read the Western history of state thought and its critiques, as well as reading the kind of classical texts that those early modern Europeans understood to be their heritage, so we understood what kind of imaginative resources they were drawing upon, which means Greeks, or classical texts, Greeks and Romans, basically. And so, while we could, in a sense, kind of denaturalize this Eurocentric history of political theory that is prevalent in Western courses on political theory, the course as we had structured it that first year couldn't go beyond that history, and it couldn't get outside the parameters defined by the object of our critique, that is, the modern state. Remaining within those parameters, we ended up leaving aside all of the traditions of political theory and also doing injustice to the very texts that we were reading. For instance, tearing Plato, Aristotle, and the Stoics out of the many different worlds that they were part of and the many different worlds within which they were read, worlds spanning Asia, Africa, Southern Europe, and making them part of a single Western tradition. Right? So that was fine for our first year, we felt. But for the second year, we needed to try to address this question of how to engage with the diversity of other traditions of political theory while also providing a rigorous grounding in the theory and critique of the modern state. And so our first reform was to expand the syllabus to include a unit on classical Islamic political theory. Of course, many Western surveys of political theory often include a section on Islamic political thought. But of course, it's always presented in a very specific way, as Islamic thinkers rescuing the Greeks from oblivion so that they could then be re-rescued by medieval Europeans. And of course, also the favorite Islamic writers for this approach to Islamic political theory were the Falsafa, those who were explicitly writing about and in conversation with ancient Greek writers, and especially those who were seen as friendly to Western rationalism, secularism, and skepticism, those seen as being anti-fundamentalist. And of course, this alienation involved a very famous renaming project, right? Ibn Rushd became Averroes, Ibn Sina became Avicenna, and so on. Mm-hmm. And I saw that article in The Guardian about Psoas, and then the reading list at the end. Who does he go to? Ibn Rushd, right? Averroes, in order to, because he is anti-fundamentalist. So we wanted to avoid this Eurocentric co-optation of Islamic political theory that made it just an ancillary to Western political theory. And so what we did is we tried to, or in my courses, I tried to present a kind of broad approach to some major questions in Islamic political thought. Of course, I included the falsafa, and I included Ibn Khaldun's Muqaddimah. But it was, these were put in the context of a broader set of readings by other philosophers, jurists, and theologians, people like al-Shafi, al-Juwayni, al-Mawardi, the princely advice of Nizam al-Mulk, writings of al-Jahiz, and of course the critique of the falsafa, especially by al-Ghazali, who's, we spent a lot of time on al-Ghazali, I remember. So as you remember, as you might realize, for me, this was a massive learning project. I didn't know a thing about it going into it, so it took months and months and months of reading. We had to order all these books to the Meiser Library and sort of in order to be able to figure this out. Even by the time I was teaching, I still had just scratching the surface. So teaching was, you know, for me, for everybody, learning it ourselves, going through the debates. And now it turned out that including Islamic political thought, even in this very amateur way that I did, worked very well in that context for a number of reasons. Obviously, we're able to engage with a non-Western body of political thought that had its own problematics, so its own debates and questions, its own approaches to rule, to justice, and so forth. Of course, the Islamic tradition did that, but it also overlapped enough with European traditions that we were reading in other parts of that class in terms of shared engagement with the Greeks, shared religious traditions, enough so that these familiar threads helped us approach Islamic writing. It also worked very well in that context because many of our students at Meiser already had some kind of knowledge of Islamic political thought, and Islamic political thought is of very significant relevance in today's East Africa. And so for those students interested in contemporary Islamic political thought, having a grounding in the classics was indispensable. And so what changing the course that first term did, the first semester, then enabled us to engage with contemporary Islamic thinkers in the second semester. So, of course, we had the usual suspects of Nietzsche, Lenin, Gramsci, Arendt, and Foucault in there. But in addition, we read Muhammad Abduh, Hassan al-Banna, Said Qutb, and Ali Shariati. And so that was sort of the first step that we took. And then we developed it from there. But I think the point I want to get to is that even with the addition of sort of Islamic political philosophers, the class that I was teaching remained a kind of traditional disciplinary political theory class. We were reading texts that conform to, well, I always like Rajiv Bhargava's definition of political theory. He says political theory is a political discourse that is a systematic reflection concerned with the uses, meanings, and relations between concepts. It has a structure based on the provision of reasons, aspiration to truth, generality, and some attention to empirical conditions and an effort to reflect on those. So in a sense, we remained within that kind of field of political theory. Now, we were only able to do that, and we were only able to keep the classes that I was teaching sort of as they were and bracket some of the questions of context and history and sources and what theory itself is. We were only able to do that because those two classes that I was teaching were not the only places where political theory was being taught in our curriculum. So again, to quote Rajiv Bhargava, he says, quote, "We must jettison the thought that political theory is done or learned only in the departments of political science. Departments of social science, history, literature, and philosophy provide equally good settings for the birth and teaching of political theory. It is inherently interdisciplinary." And so in our other classes, we also read political theorists and political theory. Just to take one class, I pulled it up last night and pulled out the people on the reading list. Edward Said, Samir Amin, Du Bois, Sheikh Anta Diop, Ajayi, Rodney, Yusuf, Ubala, Usman, Oyerunke, Oyewumi, Mudimbe, Rodney, Chatterjee, Mukandawire, Lumumba, Nyerere, Cabral and Fanon, Bamba, or Baba, Homi Baba, and Claude Ake. And most of these were explicitly writing political theory. And in a broader sense, sort of all of our classes were dealing with political theory. All of them sought to historicize and theorize and to use those who were able to have conversations of political theory across the classes. So it was okay that we bracketed some of these questions in the classes that I was teaching, because honestly, I had no business teaching or dealing with some of these broader questions of sources of different histories, these kinds of things. And so, of course, this did bring up a broader question, which is the connection or the relation between what we might think of as political theory and political thought. Of course, this makes me a bit nervous talking about this, because we have two experts on African political thought in the room with Michael Onyebuchadze and with Hassan Mwakimako. So both of you, be patient with me, but I look forward to hearing what you think. And so we had a debate over, what are the boundaries between political theory and political thought? Should African political theory be maintained as a distinct discipline or collapsed into a broader realm of political thought? And so I think the approach we ended up taking was to see political theory as sort of one mode of political thought, one form of political thought being a broader set of discourses that can be institutionalized or non-institutional, long-lasting or fleeting, popular, local or global. And political theory we might see as a particular set of traditions within these discourses. And of course, then they also require different methods for study. Political theory might require an attention to conceptual clarity, rooting out assumptions and presuppositions, internal critique. Studying political thought might require those, but also requires an intense knowledge of debates over oral sources, archives, historical sources, ethnography, translation, and so on. As I said, debates that I have no expertise in, but that fortunately my colleagues at Miser lived and breathed every day. So I think that even if we do draw a line between them, and I think in that context there was a utility for doing so, at least in terms of the way the courses were structured, the key is to maintain that line as porous, to understand political theory as porous to discourses, traditions, and debates that may otherwise be relegated to political thought, and openness to the recognition that political theory production can be extra-disciplinary and extra-institutional. And so the study of political theory and political thought is a process of studying, researching on their own terms, the traditions, histories, legacies, especially the debates over time or through time among interlocutors on key political issues. And so the challenge then becomes how to make these diverse forms of political theory accessible within the curriculum, or these diverse forms of political thought. Of course, we have to ask how to access oral forms of political theorizing. And these are the kinds of things that Hassan, of course, has written a lot on. Texts whose reference and concerns are so opaque or which are so fragmentary to us that we need extensive interpretation to understand these texts. What does it mean for, say, my access to certain traditions of political thought to be mediated by someone who may be from outside that tradition of political theory, say an academic somewhere within an academic institution, and is perhaps part of a disciplinary academic community? These were all the questions that we were struggling with, I think, in a very productive manner. Now, my hope, too, is that in that context, taking this kind of approach could help us kind of navigate kind of dichotomy between the local and the universal in political theory. On the one hand, we're avoiding the notion that political theory is universal, an idea which, of course, because of many of the concept's Western origins, amounts to a declaration of the unique universality of the West, as we've been talking about. On the other, rejecting the idea that theory is all necessarily entirely, quote, local, right? That theorization is local, and so any political concept can only have meaning established within a certain immediate local context. And so the approach that I think we adopted, as I understand it, is that to reject the Western-centric universality of political theory doesn't necessitate a reversion to the entirely local. Instead, we kind of drew a distinction between the universal which declares itself to be necessary, and what we might call the generalizable, which is contingent, historical, simply a recognition that concepts have a possibility to gain relevance or find resonance in futures outside of the context in which they're deployed in the present. And so our study then becomes sort of looking to concepts, uses, and possibilities within what we might call regional histories. Histories of regional histories between a universal history and a purely local history. They're generalizable, but they're contingent. It's histories of debate, practice, arguments, and often violence. And so seeing concepts as informed by and within regional histories gives them the possibility to find application elsewhere without claiming for them universality. And so perhaps this was able to help us kind of do justice to the plurality of political theory based upon the pluralities within Africa. So that political theory even is urban and rural, comes out of the local and the global, of civil and political society. And so at Miser, I think we often felt that our theory was, in a sense, yet to come. As Huntunji says, admit then that our philosophy is yet to come. Take the word philosophy in the active, not passive sense. We felt that, too, theory was yet to come, and that we were doing theory in an active instead of a passive sense. So what are the lessons, what might be the lessons of this experience for the question that we're dealing with here, of decolonizing political theory here? Well, as you notice, a word that I haven't used yet is decolonization. And we didn't actually use it much in those early years at Miser. It's become more prominent in the last few years as connections have developed between students there and in some of the student movements in South Africa. But we weren't sure that it was the right word to use in that context, and certainly not as kind of the master signifier. And so at Makerere, at Miser, we weren't framing our project in terms of decolonization. Partly strategically, simply because we didn't have the time. We were trying to sort of build something that we hoped would be new, so we didn't have time to sort of lament the colonial province of some of the terms we were using with. Instead, we were trying to use them and see what we could do with them, see what would happen. It might have been a mistake. But also it was based on a kind of idea or a feeling that maybe deconstructing from that context, deconstructing British or European thought, denouncing its silencing of Africa, might not be relevant anymore. And so, because sort of affirming the existence of African political thought against the long-standing historical silence imposed by the West, it just didn't seem like that's the main concern at African universities. It may still be a radical idea here at Cambridge. I think it is. But of course, everywhere else, it's an old idea with long legacies to it. And I think that by framing our project at that point as one of decolonization, it would have led us to fail to engage with decades of actually existing decolonization of knowledge production and decolonization of the university. It would let us to be able to sort of bypass the long critical literatures on those and would have allowed us to not take the lessons from the last 50 years, whether positive or critical, of that actually existing decolonization. It ended up being sort of, it could have been ahistorical, right? And so I think that in a sense, deconstructing the Eurocentrism of Western thought, decolonizing the political theory that's done here, affirming the existence of African political thought, yes, this might still be a concern for African studies in Europe and the US, and it's certainly still a concern here at Cambridge, and it also may be a concern in South Africa, although in South Africa there's vigorous and often vicious debates on this right now, but I'm not sure that it's the foremost concern for political studies elsewhere in Africa or even in much of the world. And even here in Britain, I feel like it takes an institution as isolated and insulated from the social context, from social dynamics, from global changes as Cambridge, for colonized thinking and theory to still be dominant. And maybe soon, Cambridge is going to be one of the last places in the world where deconstructing British thought on Africa is still progressive. Right? But of course, the fact that it may still be progressive only shines a light on how parochial our political theory is here.
how isolated we are here from global intellectual trends and movements and developments. And so I also don't think we want to, you know, let off focus solely on decolonization lead us to reinflate the importance of the West through the very process of seeking to dismantle it. And I think at most dangerous, it can even run the risk of seeming to reprise the kind of intellectual exceptionalism that has typically characterized the West towards the rest of the world and characterized South Africa towards the rest of Africa. And so I see the task for decolonizing political theory here as twofold. One can take place in the discipline of politics and sociology, anthropology, and the other, for me at least, in African studies. But it's in African studies that refuses the geographical boundaries inherited from colonial studies of Africa. And so it is both to make political theory porous to political thought, but then to make African studies generalizable as theory. And so I think this for us would be only the beginning, in a sense. And that kind of decolonization of political theory here is just a first step to prepare ourselves to engage with the rest of the world, to start to catch up to the rest of the world by providing the basis for us to then ask entry into conversations and debates that are already going on in the rest of the world, that are affirmative, constructive projects of knowledge production beyond decolonization that are already happening across the globe today. So thanks.